is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Pandemic lockdowns aren't slowing down our shopping habits. Instead of spending time and money at the mall, many are turning to online retailers for fashion. Shein, a Chinese clothing company, had its biggest year of sales during the pandemic. Last month, it overtook Amazon as the most downloaded shopping app in the iOS App Store. And according to data from Earnest Research, Shein comprised 28% of U.S. fast fashion sales, surpassing H&M, Zara, and Forever 21 last month. Here to talk fast fashion and sustainability are Professor Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas. She's a professor of marketing and sustainable business at the British School of Fashion. Natasha, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Alden Wicker, a journalist and the founder of EcoCult.com. That's a platform dedicated to sustainable fashion. Alden, welcome.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's start with this question that Chris writes on Facebook. What is the difference between fast fashion and cheap fashion? Walmart, Target, and pretty much every retail outlet has clothing made outside the U.S. Aren't they all held to the same ethical concerns? So I'll just kick things off for us with a quick definition. What is fast fashion?
So fast fashion is fashion that is not created in seasonal collections ahead of time, but is just created on the fly according to what trends are coming up or what celebrities have been seen wearing out and about. So it's always churning through, and it's cheaper and, of course, faster. It might be shipped instead of by ship, by airplane, so flown across the world so it gets here within a few weeks.
And what is the distinction between what we would see from Shein and what we might see at Walmart or Target?
So Shein has taken the concept of fast fashion and stretched it way further. So it's even cheaper, even faster. It's just trying to scrape the bottom of what is possible in terms of turning fashion into a completely throwaway commodity. So something that has almost no value, you can wear it once, throw it out, and you feel no pain in your wallet from doing that.
Natasha, how has fast fashion changed through the years? Let's look at the store Zara, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because when we think of fast fashion nowadays, it has a lot of negative connotations. The origins really were kind of trying to, I suppose, democratize fashion. And someone like Zara, when they came on the scene, you know, their ambition was to bring the runway trend straight into the, you know, into the high street retailers so that you could be wearing the same things as you were seeing on the runway within a matter of weeks. And so it's really kind of trend led. But that's, I suppose, due to economic efficiencies, just as Alden said, that system has speeded up. And so it doesn't sort of reflect any kind of seasons now. It's really fashion on demand.
Mm. Alden, what's the history of these super popular online retailers like Shein and ASOS? When did we start to see those emerge?
So actually, we started seeing something that I like to call, or a lot of people like to call, ultra fast fashion emerge probably 4 or 5 years ago with your British brands Boohoo and Misguided, which also made a big splash in the United States. And they came in and started undercutting H&M and Zara and Target and Walmart, not just in their speed, but also in their ability to pick up on trends and throw them on the site. Sometimes they'll even use Kardashian model lookalikes to sort of imply that the dress that they're offering for $25 or $15 is the almost exact dress that one of the Kardashians wore maybe a week ago.
Mm. And how would you describe Shein to someone who's never heard of it? They're like, what are they talking about?
It's sort of like, Shein is sort of like as close as you can get to frictionless sort of binge shopping on social media. So instead of having the thoughtfulness to sort of go online even, or go to a store definitely, but go online and sort of say, okay, like, let me look around at everything and see, you know, what appeals to me. I'm looking for something specific. It's just sort of brings mindless scrolling and one-click shopping to your phone in a way that really tugs on your emotions, the way the algorithm of Instagram or even more accurately, TikTok does.
And I think it's fair to say that while this is the most popular online retailer in the world, it's still relatively unknown. How did that happen?
I don't know. I mean, even to me, I started seeing its name come up just a few months ago, and it's astounding to me that something that, that's so incredibly massive is flying under the radar of basically everyone except its target market, which is, Gen Z, young, cash poor, but very online, generation.
And we should mention we reached out to Shein for comment, but we didn't get a response. We're talking to journalists Alden Wicker and Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas of the British School of Fashion about fast fashion. Now, Natasha, what are some examples of popular stores and companies that don't fall under that fast fashion umbrella?
Well, I think what's really interesting in the last few years is that all sort of stores have picked up on this kind of model, and they want to get the kind of efficiencies that someone like Shein or ASOS or Boohoo have. And I think what it is more about is the price point, because anyone who's trying to deliver, really good economic value cannot really undercut these practices. But what I would say is a lot of it is really supported by the technology. And I think someone like Shein has the advantages of the data analytics, and that's really where their strength is. And they're really responding, as Alden said, to sort of algorithms and really picking up on the pulse of what people want. I think there's an opposite movement, though, from some brands who are trying to be more sort of slow and stepping out of the system. And it's something that we'll have to wait and see whether it's successful or not, because during all the sort of lockdowns, a lot of, the fashion organizations like the CFDA and the British Fashion Council were talking about resetting fashion and really wanting to slow down the pace. But we don't really have a workable model for that as such
Are there
at the
any
moment.
brands you can mention that come to mind?
Well, I think what I would say in terms of brands are someone like Christopher Raeburn. He's an honorary professor of ours, and he actually also works with Timberland as their creative director. And he's really working in this space of zero waste and circularity, and trying to design out waste at the beginning of the process to slow down, to be seasonless, to make to demand, so that you're actually having a really deep relationship with your customers rather than having this sort of fleeting just through volume. And so that kind of model is also being promoted, through the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And they're working with a range of people, like Levi's, for example, to try to redesign things like denim, which has a massive impact because, all of us love jeans, and everyone, it's a product that everyone's buying. And trying to ask the big sort of brands to look at their production processes and to actually make them more sustainable. And part of that is building in longevity, which is the absolute opposite of fast fashion. It's the idea of buying something that you're going to hold on to for a long time. And denim's quite a good example because we have a few brands as well where we're already thinking about how do we repair them, how do we, keep them in use, launder them more sort of in a more environmentally friendly way. And someone like Patagonia was really one of the starting points for that, which interestingly, not really so much in the fashion space, but coming from outdoor wear. And so thinking about using good materials, designing things to last, kind of really having an emotional connection with your clothing. So you want to hold on to it, you want to repair it, you're proud to sort of have the, patches and repairs on it, and actually setting that up and making that available in store. So I think there's that, and there's also a whole range of rental. So that's another thing that's coming through really strongly, is actually the idea, I suppose, of not actually owning your clothes, but renting them
Just
so
borrowing them
that,
for a bit. I want to play a message we got from Claudia in Silver Spring.
I'm a teacher in the county, and I was wearing very comfortable pants for all of the time I was teaching, and then by the time I had to go back in the classroom, I realized, oh no, I have to put on real pants now. And then it started dawning on me how I was shopping when I was spending so much time at home. And I just felt like I had to make a more ethical decision for my wardrobe. So it actually helped shift me in a good direction towards sustainable clothing.
Claudia, thanks for that message. We also got this tweet from Sierra who says, I feel bad for shopping at Shein, and I'll openly lie about where I got something from because I don't want to promote them, but I'm broke and they make the cheapest, cutest things. Alden, how much does affordability play a role in fast fashion, especially with the pandemic and lots of people, feeling financially strapped?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a contingent of people who shop at these ultra fast fashion brands who can't really afford more, right? We have a lot of Americans at the bottom who are making minimum wage, and you know, they deserve to feel cute and attractive too, right? But there's also a lot of people who probably could afford more, but you know, I like to say never underestimate the power of people to justify being cheap. And I think also, you know, you talked in the intro to this show about how, you know, if you ask consumers, they'll always say, oh, yes, absolutely, I would pay more for sustainable fashion. But the thing is that sustainable fashion is a very nebulous word. It doesn't really mean anything, and it's not really measurable. And so, you know, if you say, yes, I would absolutely pay more for sustainable fashion, well, how much more would you pay and for what, right? Like, how much more is organic cotton worth? And how much more is a smaller carbon footprint worth? And what is a small carbon footprint? These are all things that consumers don't have the time or, you know, advanced degree to really understand. And so when they're looking at something that's a $250 organic cotton made by artisans, hand embroidered dress, and they're looking at something that is incredibly affordable so they can get it in three colors, they might just go for the more affordable one because they're not even sure that the extra money they're paying is going to the artisan or
Take a quick break. We're talking to journalist Alden Wicker and Natasha Radcliffe Thomas of the British School of Fashion. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing fast fashion with Natasha Radcliffe Thomas of the British School of Fashion. Also with us, journalist Alden Wicker. And let's bring one more voice into the conversation. Dana Thomas is the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been writing about fashion for 30 years. How do you react to this boom in ultra fast fashion?
Well, I find it a bit disheartening. Because, you know, once you've written a whole book on the horrors of fast fashion, you really hope that somebody's read it and has listened. It's very disheartening because we're all obsessed, I mean, as we need to be, with climate change and worrying about the planet. And yet we're burning through clothes at an exponential rate. And where do they all wind up? In landfill, a moldering for eternity, because most of them are made of plastic, and which is what polyester is, and will never biodegrade. So while we say we care and we really want to, you know, we can recycle all our plastic bottles that we want, we're still burning through clothes at an unprecedented rate, and the impact is immeasurable on the planet.
Alden, I want to circle back to the whole idea of people being cheap. Sedge emails this: I think the increasing popularity of cheap fast fashion is largely due to the sharp increase in housing costs over the last decade. Looking at humanity's basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter, it's generally easier and healthier to reduce spending in the clothing category. I believe that also helps explain the popularity of thrift stores. And we'll talk more about thrifting a little later in the hour. But, you know, there is a reality. Wages have stagnated. Lots of people are out of work. People still need to get dressed. So how does that fit into this conversation? Because some people, I can hear people saying, I'm not cheap, I'm broke.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a fair thing to say. Fashion is one of the only product categories that has shrunk its share of how much budget people put towards it. You know, food prices have gone up, housing prices have indeed skyrocketed. You know, transportation costs, all of these things. And clothing is necessary, right? We can't walk around naked. We need something to keep us warm in the winter. So, and I totally, absolutely get that. At the same time, I still don't believe there's evidence that everybody who shops at Shein and other ultra fast fashion brands are, you know, really low on budget. And I do remember being in that place when I was 16 where, you know, Express was like a huge splurge for me. And like, maybe I could get a, you know, a shirt there one day. And Abercrombie and Fitch was like way out of my budget. But, you know, teenagers are going to buy as much as they can. And, you know, there is a disconnect where people, they want to do well for the planet. And I think about my nieces in this way. They're very much into climate change, but also, you know, they love to shop. So it's just sort of the hedonic treadmill, right? Like, people are just going to prioritize where they're going to prioritize. And if fashion is getting ever cheaper, it's just really hard to keep in mind this sort of person that you've never met across the world who may or may not be being exploited by this, and also sort of this grand idea of climate change, which, mm-hmm. and it's a lot to put on a consumer it to is. Expect them to keep all of this in mind.
Natasha, I want to hear your thoughts on this, especially around this question of affordability.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, I think we've really got used to clothes being really, really cheap. So we're not used to spending money on them. And it's really kind of devalued. And I think a lot of us are separated from the making. So we don't really have a concept of what goes into, you know, producing a fabric and to making it. And so we've just got used to, and we've also got used to promotions. So I think what I would say, a lot of people now, they either want to splurge on a designer piece or they want something discounted. And that's another technique that the kind of fast fashion model encourages, is just endless sales promotions. So I think we've definitely, a lot of us have a sort of attitude behavior sort of gap where people are full of good intentions. Think about, you know, your diet and food. People have a lot of good intentions for doing the right thing, but then they just sort of get pulled in and get tempted. And then they can kind of justify to themselves those decisions that they've made. But I also think we have to look at, you know, the people behind these brands. There's certainly money somewhere, and they're kind of extracting that from us and extracting it from the workers. So I think it's a really unhealthy business model. And that's the sort of thing, the piece that really troubles me the most, I think.
Well, we heard from a number of you online about how fast fashion can sometimes be the only plus size clothing option available. Nicole tweets, "I'm fat, broke, and still want to look cute for girls' night out, brunch, and date, so fast fashion it is. I also don't have the patience or eye for thrift styling, so no, I don't prioritize sustainability." Nia tweets, "Definitely with plus size fashion, I'm not able to think sustainability. There was already not a lot of cute plus size clothes to begin with, so I resort to Fashion Nova, Pretty Little Thing, etc." And Jordan tweets, "Because I'm plus size, fast fashion is often the way I go for trendy clothes that fit my budget and my body. I hate Shein and everything they stand for, but I still buy." Now, Alden, you run EcoCult.com, which is a blog focused on sustainable fashion. How does size inclusivity affect how people shop?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've written about this before, and I've tried to share a small but expanding number of plus size brands that also are focused on sustainability. And yeah, they're more expensive. And also, there's the idea that, you know, true sustainable fashion doesn't have polyester in it or plastics in it, but that actually limits plus size or extended sizing or inclusive sizing shopping, because if you don't have stretch in a piece of clothing, then it's just harder to find a good fit, right? Like, you have to get something, you would have to get something exclusively tailored to your body. And if you don't have, you know, that perfect hourglass shape, then you need stretch. I mean, we all need stretch. Everything, a lot of things do look better when they can stretch out to fit your body. So that is a huge obstacle to accessing what people consider sustainable fashion if you are above a size 14.
Jazz tweets this, "As much as I'd love to think about sustainability while shopping, I truly do not care. I need clothing that fits and flatters my body, and secondhand stores and sites don't carry cute things in my size. My happiness in my own skin takes precedence over anything else." Now, Dana, a lot of popular sustainable fashion brands like Everlane, Girlfriend Collective sell basics and athletic wear. How do you react to the idea that fast fashion is sometimes the only option for people who want to try new clothes, or maybe take some fashion risks?
Well, that's, as everyone else has said so far, we've been conditioned to think it's normal to pay so little for clothes. Clothes have never been cheaper than they are today. We spend between 4 and 5 times less money on clothes than we did a generation ago. We buy 4 to 5 times more than we did a generation ago. I was earning $1 an hour babysitting, and clothes cost the same amount as my teenage daughter, who earns $10 an hour. She has 10 times the purchasing power, therefore she buys 10 times more clothes. We used to come home with 1 or 2 items in a bag. Now we come home with 10. The average garment is worn three times in China and 7 times elsewhere in the world before it's thrown away. 7 times before we throw it away. So we've been conditioned to think it's normal to get a new dress for a Friday night date rather than shopping our closet, because they want you to come in and spend and buy. 6 of the top richest 50 people in the world own fashion companies today. And yet 98% of the people who make fashion are not paid a living wage. So where do you think all that profit is going? The people who make those cheap clothes that you think are really adorable and you wear 7 times before you throw it away, if it costs $20, they were paid 20 cents to make it. Maybe we should think a little bit more and invest in our clothing and cherish our clothing rather than throw it away, and think about its origins and the impact it has on humanity and the planet, and not just what we look at, see in the mirror.
Alden, how does fast fashion affect trend cycles?
Oh, I mean, it speeds them up. I mean, it is insane how quickly a celebrity can wear something and what they call a dupe or a duplicate shows up on one of these sites. And it sort of, social media really is driving this, though. It's sort of, they have social media has a symbiotic relationship with fast fashion, right? Like, things move through social media really quickly, and then everybody piles in to buy the thing and wear it once, and then they can't wear it again because, you know, social media, so they move on to the next thing. So I think it's sort of a chicken and the egg. It's like these ultra-fast fashion brands rose to meet the occasion provided by social media, and then social media sort of eggs them on, making new stuff that can get more likes more quickly.
Natasha, as someone who teaches at a fashion school, how has fast fashion affected the way young designers approach their work? Natasha, are you with us?
I think really interestingly is a lot of young designers are interested in sustainability, and they're actually questioning the model of fast fashion. So I would say young designers are really interested in how to change the industry. But where are the jobs? I mean, if the jobs are working for brands that are producing this way, I mean, it's really difficult. But I think we're seeing a lot of people turning away from this model. They don't want to embrace it. And I think, you know, the growing interest in more sustainable fashion is definitely with younger people who are designers of the future.
Alden, can you break down sort of maybe some generational differences here? Because the assumptions that people are only, you know, using these pieces of clothing a few times and then throwing them out. And I don't know that that's absolutely true. Maybe somebody's really stretching out the wear on that Shein shirt or those Shein pants because it's what they can afford. So they've got to make them last a little longer. It feels like a lot of the lens of this conversation is coming through what teens are doing. Can you give us any more context there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I have an H&M dress that I bought 10 years ago and it still looks great. So it's possible to shop at these places thoughtfully, right? I mean, if you really are hard up for a budget, then of course, like, find the thing that you love the most and that you're going to wear. It will probably wear out faster. You know, there's there's an old saying that I'm too poor to buy cheap stuff because it breaks so quickly. But, you know, it's interesting to see the waves of this moving through because boomers actually are more likely to shop at a unrecognized fast fashion brand, which is Costco. So they have a lot of cheap fast fashion there, and also sort of like logoed brands that the boomer generation really loves. And the boomer generation doesn't necessarily think about sustainability. It's sort of just like, oh, I just want to get the cutest stuff. I know my aunt and my mom both have way more sweaters than they could ever wear in a year. And then you get the millennials who started to care more about this and are moving into having a little bit more money. And then you have I skipped over Gen X, which, you know, was more rebellious and but doesn't really think about this as much. And then Gen Z, which is a little bit has a split personality, cares deeply about climate change, but also cares deeply about looking cute. And I think, you know, get older and move into jobs and can afford a little bit more, they're likely to support artisan designers that have, you know, an ethos, but also they're really supporting secondhand fashion, which is affordable and does move pretty quickly and you can pick up on trends there and experiment. And so that's something that Gen Z is pushing forward.
We're talking about fast fashion with journalist Alden Wicker, Natasha Radcliffe Thomas of the British School of Fashion, and Dana Thomas, author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. We also want to hear from you. What questions do you have about fast fashion? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. KA tweets this, I started almost exclusively sewing my own clothes. My budget is fast fashion, but I don't like contributing to sweatshop labor, so clothes made to fit me and mended by me when they wear will get more use and be more sustainable in the long run. Dana, when we talk about the environmental impact of fast fashion, what are the biggest polluters? Is it the manufacturer or the single-use plastic packaging or the clothes themselves?
All of the above. Can I have D, all of the above? It's from the factories, which are in far-flung places that we don't see anymore and follow no environmental or safety standards. And there's no government oversight because that's part of the reason they're so cheap for the contractors and for the brands to use. Then there's the shipping all the way around the world. There's the single-use plastic. There's the leftovers going into the straight into the dump. You know, less than, you know, single digit percentage of clothing is recycled or winds up in thrift shops or in charity shops. It winds up in the landfill. Then there's the dyes. There's the processing of tree pulp to turn into rayon. There's all of the chemicals on the cotton, which is just, don't even let's get started there. The dye of denim, which has formaldehyde and all sorts of toxic chemicals in it. And it just gets washed off straight into rivers. And it's on our skin. So, you know, once you start digging into what goes into making clothes that are not quote unquote sustainable, it's a little bit horrifying. It's kind of like the fast food industry and you start finding out what's really in that hamburger meat and you go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. If I did, I wouldn't do that.
Well, let's play this message we got from Saida in Pennsylvania.
I discovered a while ago that polyester comes from fossil fuels. So I have made a serious effort to buy only cotton, linen, silk, or wool, because those are the only natural fibers. I can't even imagine how many fossil fuels are being used to create most of the fashion, most of the clothes we wear today.
Natasha, for designers who are trying to move in the other direction, what are they thinking about in terms of the textiles they use?
It's a really interesting question, and this is one that's so complex even for designers, because whilst we might think, well, natural fibers are definitely the best choice, there's also resource impact. You know, when we're looking at something like cotton, which is one of the most widely used textiles, that uses a lot of water in its production. And then we need to think about whether we're dyeing things and that type of thing. So it really is a challenge. But what I would say is, in terms of something that's going to biodegrade at the end of its life, then definitely natural fabrics. But something like linen is getting a lot of interest from designers at the moment because it's a really sustainable and hard-wearing crop. And so we're seeing a lot of interest in sort of innovators in looking at some of those more traditional fabrics and maybe bring those back into the fashion scene.
We're discussing fast fashion with Natasha Radcliffe Thomas of the British School of Fashion. Also with us, journalist Alden Wicker and Dana Thomas. She's the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Amanda tweets this, I think that if you have the means to purchase higher quality sustainable brands, it's inherently selfish to partake in fast fashion such as Shein. But without money, I wouldn't put it past a person for indulging in these consumer trends. And Samantha tweets this, it's the fashion and celebrity complex and people's obsession with wearing cute and trendy items. That's the problem. Why do styles have to change? We need to get rid of the idea that what is fashionable has to be changing all the time. We'll get our panel's response to that after the break. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. She ain't nothing but a little doozy when she does it. She's so fine tonight. And as long as I got my suit and tie, I'm gonna leave it all on the floor tonight. And you got fixed up to the nines. Let me show you a few things. All pressed up in black and white. Dressed in that dress I like. Love is swinging in the air tonight. Let me show you a few things. Let me show you a few things. This is 1A. Now let's get back to fast fashion and sustainability with Dana Thomas. She's the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Also with us, Natasha Radcliffe Thomas of the British School of Fashion and journalist Alden Wicker. I want to get your reaction, Natasha, to that tweet we got from Samantha about the fashion and celebrity complex and people's obsession with wearing cute and trendy items, because there's clothes, right? And then there's fashion. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really worrying about the kind of social media piece is that a lot of these clothes aren't even worn. People are ordering multiple clothes, you know, just for a photo shoot, for, you know, for Instagram or for TikTok, for a haul, and then they're not even wearing them. So I think they've almost become this abstract thing where they're not actually clothes and fashion. And I think, you know, it's a real challenge for the industry, because fashion is nothing if it's not reflecting culture. But at the moment, with this sort of ugly business model, it's not a very pretty sight.
Well, and Alden, Natasha mentioned hauls there, and this is part of what happens on social media. Can you just explain this?
Yeah, so a haul is when on YouTube or TikTok, somebody goes out to one of these fast fashion stores or goes online to an ultra fast fashion e-commerce site, and they just buy as much as possible. And then the video is just them taking things out of their bag or box and holding it up and talking about it. And so it's extremely extravagant, even though it might not have cost them more than $100 to get all of these little things.
Here's an email we got from John, who says, "Overconsumption is so bad for everything. I buy or make quality clothing and wear it until it is worn out. Of course, I am 71, but still." And Beatrice emails, "I have a dress that I bought at Raleigh's department store in D.C. in 1986. I still have it, still wear it, and love it." And Kim tweets this, "I absolutely think about sustainability as well as ethical workplace practices when I shop. I have also adopted a more minimalist approach to clothing purchases. It allows me to shop my conscience and appreciate my closet more." Dana, can you explain a bit about the workplace practices at fast fashion companies?
Absolutely. I went to Bangladesh and saw the sweatshops right off of the airplane, but also I saw them in Los Angeles. And we don't think about sweatshops in America because we have the Labor Department that enforces these labor rules throughout the country. But sweatshops, underground sweatshops, most definitely exist. And about half the clothes in downtown LA are made in illegal sweatshops with people who have no papers and are paid $2 an hour instead of the minimum wage, which I think is working its way up to $15 an hour in California, and no benefits whatsoever. And then they have to cash their checks at the check cashing place owned by the guy who paid them, so they lose half their check there. These places are rat traps, and they are fire traps. And, you know, even in downtown LA, the fire escape is falling off the wall. You don't want to walk on it, much less, you know, and then it only goes halfway down the building. And it's in right there in downtown LA, steps from Disney Hall, you know? And you go like, how does this keep going on? And the Labor Department does what it does. It can to fight them. But these brands that we know in America, like Forever 21 and other American fast fashion brands out of LA, they source from these companies and these workshops. And you go, how and why? And they keep saying, well, we didn't know that they were subcontracting to sweatshops. They know everything. If the color isn't exactly the color they ordered, they'll send it back. If the button is exactly where it should be, they'll send it back. You're gonna tell me they don't know where their clothes are made? That's bunk. So, you know, and when we see Made in America, we think, oh, it must be fine then. But a lot of it isn't. So basically, if you're buying fast fashion, you're buying into this machine where 98% of the people who make the clothes are not paid a living wage, which is just the minimum we need, economists say, to house, clothe, and feed our families. And we can say we can't afford it. Listen, I'm a writer. You think we have any money? But, you know, we're contributing to our own poverty in a sense. Say you work at one of these stores, you work at Walmart, and you're underpaid. So then you say, I can't afford to buy more. So then I'm going to shop in these stores where everyone else is underpaid. And we all become part of this machine where everyone is not valued as they should be, including what they're making. So we need to, if we can, just rise up a little bit. If it means you have to pay 50% more for something great, it's going to last you twice, three times, four times, five times as long, and it will look so much better, One of these fashion brand CEOs once told me, a fast fashion item never looks as good as the first time you wear it. He's not kidding. And just a general rule of thought, if it costs more to dry clean it than replace it, then you probably shouldn't be buying it.
Natasha, that does raise this question about transparency, and especially when we're talking about online retailers, how transparent do they have to be about their labor practices?
Well, I think one thing is that we really need government legislation on this. But I think at the moment, the push is coming more from the consumers. I mean, as we've heard, younger people are increasingly interested in sustainability. And one of the ways that they see this evidence is through talking about factories that people are using. And it's become quite a popular thing now on websites to show, you know, these are the factories we're working with and to show sustainability credentials. But of course, they're only going to tell you the bit of the story that they want to tell you. And this is where we have the trouble of sort of greenwashing and kind of, the lack of transparency, because at the moment they're divulging what they want to tell you. They can show you the factories they source from. They can talk about materials that they use, but they're not going to tell you the negative parts of the story. So that is a bit of a problem. Plus, it's complicated for people. A lot of people don't want to. I mean, some people are not interested in that. Even those of us who are interested, it's a bit of a minefield. How do we unpick all of this? How do we know how to rate and rank, you know, what we're seeing there? But I do think it's been really interesting to me through the lockdown and the pandemic that we've all become experts on supply chains. You know, we all started to think about, you know, where do our clothes come from? Who's making them? There was a big campaign called Pay Up when the factories got, closed down and orders were cancelled. And I think this has come to people's consciousness a lot more in the mainstream. So, and I think once that knowledge is sort of out of the box, I don't think it's going to go back. And I also think there's a lot of pressure from within the industry. So I think there are lots of people working within brands who want to do, it's not nice to work for a company if you don't think they're actually doing the right thing. So I think we're kind of having pressure externally and internally, but it also is going to come in terms of legislation with things like extended producer sort of liability, where brands are going to be responsible for, not just all the supply to the store, but then what happens to their goods afterwards, as we have with other items like white goods. So I think it's going to come that way, and people will have to sort of sign up to letting us know a little bit more of their production. But I think one of the things at the moment that we haven't really talked about is the finance of this and the tax breaks that these online retailers get that enable them to, charge the low prices that the physical stores can't. So that's a kind of bit of a, it's not exactly not transparent, but it's something that's sort of almost staring us in the face, but we don't really notice it so much.
Just want to mention Forever 21 has been investigated for sweatshop conditions, but 1A and NPR can't confirm those claims of illegal labor independently. You mentioned greenwashing, and can you just explain what that is, Natasha?
Yeah, it's a little bit, because sustainability has become almost a trend. And so lots of brands want to talk about their sustainable credentials and maybe stretch the truth a little bit. So the greenwashing concept really is when people use words like eco or ethical, but they don't really necessarily, it's not necessarily backed up with anything. And so, as consumers, even if we see the color green, we might start to think something is more sustainable. It gives it that kind of halo effect where we think that it's more ethical than maybe it is. And so this is a big challenge for consumers. And because, the laws around this are quite, vague, especially in different parts of the world, actually defining, as you've seen, sustainability, we've not just got materials, we've got processes, but we've also got the social side of sustainability. So for someone to even claim that they're sustainable, there's a lot to unpack there. And so I think greenwashing is really the big struggle for a lot of consumers who maybe want to do the right thing and spend their money in the right places, but they're confused. What does it mean? How do I rank this choice against that choice?
We're talking to Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas of the British School of Fashion, journalist Alden Wicker, and Dana Thomas. She's the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Here's a message we got from Elizabeth in Pittsburgh.
I actually have a business called Rediscover Your Closet, and fast fashion is something that I try to get my clients to consider when they are changing their shopping habits, and where they purchase from. Doing quality over quantity is something that can make a difference for the earth and in our world. So it's something I'm very passionate about and wanted to encourage that anyone out there shopping, look at where you're impacting. That's how we can make a difference in our world.
We also got this tweet from Catherine who says, I'm just trying to get from one day to another, and if a $6 top from Shein does it for me, so be it. Why don't we turn our attention to the big companies vomiting out 60% of the world's pollution instead? Dina, how do you react to this sense of really the onus is on the companies themselves, and whether I buy the $6 top or not isn't going to make a huge difference?
It is on the companies. I mean, come on. And you know what? No company, in fashion or otherwise, is going to say voluntarily, we're going to spend more money in production and have less profits in order to do the right thing. They won't do the right thing unless there's legislation and there's regulation. And fashion is one of the most deregulated industries we have today. I mean, if you applied the rules that we have in fashion to any other major industry, say automobiles, you could say, we don't know where the car parts are made. Can you imagine? Or in the airline industry, we don't know where the engine was made. What? What are you talking about? They would never get away with that in any other industry. There are some governments now that are stepping in and looking into putting in legislation. Germany is reviewing this and saying, listen, should we just say that we can't import clothes from countries that don't meet our labor standards and our safety standards, which means pretty much every place that the clothes are coming from outside of the EU. And most of them are coming from outside of the EU. You know, we used to make like more than 90% of our clothes in the United States at the height of globalism. It dropped down to 2%, and 98% was made overseas. And as I said before, 98% of people are not paid a living wage. So basically, everybody isn't paid a living wage is making your clothes, except the people who are making uniforms in America, because that's the last holdout. Thanks to legislation and regulation, all military uniforms must be made in America. That's the only reason we still have a domestic industry. It's coming back slowly through things like tax breaks and also what I call right shoring, where they're taking the old factories in the Carolinas, for example, and refitting them with state-of-the-art machinery and reopening them as 21st century factories with robots and vacuums to clean the air and safe work environments and better pay because you're running computers instead of running these horrible sewing machines and bad pay. The labor's coming back. The quality of clothes is coming back. There are reasons for hope, and that hope will hopefully cut or at least dim the light and the heat that comes from fast fashion. We'll all turn to something better.
Here's an email we got from Julia. Me and my group of friends, all millennials, try to keep our wardrobe sustainable by periodically having clothing swaps throughout each year. We save up the clothing we don't wear anymore and plan to donate, then get together at someone's house or the local park and shop our friend's style. The more people we have involved with more diverse styles and body types, the better our swaps have gotten. Julia, that's a great idea. Auden, when we think about eco brands that focus more on these basic pieces or activewear, not necessarily fashion, people can say, like, if I want something more fashionable, but I'm trying to be, do it in a way that's sustainable. Any advice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we buy more clothing in this country than we could ever actually donate. Like, there is a glut of secondhand clothing, a lot of it with tags, flowing through our system so much that we export probably 80% of it because we just can't sell it. So definitely go secondhand shopping. You're going to find fresh stuff that meets your needs. Some of it unworn. You can go online. You can really, you don't have to do the whole hunt through your local thrift shop, though I think that's fun. And also it keeps things in the local economy, but you can go online and there's several online places like ThredUp or Poshmark, where you can find a lot of secondhand clothing for really affordable, and you can try things out and it only costs you 15 or 20 bucks. So then you can pass it along again.
Natasha, what about from you? For people especially who feel overwhelmed by the whole thrifting experience or who just like, look, I'm not that style savvy. This isn't my lane. I just need stuff I can put on and feel comfortable in. Any advice or any eco-friendly brands that you think about?
I mean, I think in the States, you have a really good example of someone like Eileen Fisher, who really has thought about, again, this sort of having basics, having really wearable pieces. I mean, they're going to cost more, they're expensive materials, but also you can repurpose them at the, you know, when you're finished with them. But I also think a lot of the kind of department stores are moving into this space and they're curating kind of secondhand clothes for you. And also people are sort of having remake services. So I think there's a lot more kind of opportunities, you know, for customizing pieces that you've bought that maybe you're not quite sure about. I love your caller about the swapping parties. And I think something like that's great. And again, we're seeing a lot of people turning to making their own clothes, which is really, as a maker myself, that's really pleasing. So, but I think clothes should be about your identity. You should be feeling good in them. And I think it'd be really nice to have a bit more of that positive space in there. And I think, interestingly, from the research we've done, a lot of people don't mind buying fast fashion if they actually buy it from a thrift store. So they sometimes watch the piece, you know, maybe it's a Zara jacket they're really keen on, but then they just wait till it comes through into the thrift store and they'll buy it there and they'll feel less guilt about it. And they're also maybe doing good for, you know, for charity out of that.
That's Professor Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas. She's a professor of marketing and sustainable business at the British School of Fashion. Also with us today, Dana Thomas, a journalist and the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, and Alden Wicker, a journalist and the founder of EcoCult.com, a platform dedicated to sustainable fashion. Thanks to you all for joining us. Remember to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.